The American History Podcast presents the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landings.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
On Sunday, June 25th, Communist forces attacked the Republic of Korea.
We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Three representatives of one foreign power, the Soviet Union, have been expelled for spying.
It was C.S. Lewis who, in his unforgettable Screwtape letters, wrote, "The greatest evil is not done now in those sordid dens of crime that Dickens loved to paint."
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Welcome to this bonus episode of the American History Podcast. This year, 2019, is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission, which successfully landed men on the moon. I wanted to do a show on the space program overall, but that would be several shows, and this is just not possible. So one show we'll have to do. Instead, I'll talk briefly about the lead-up to the Apollo program overall, the Apollo 11 mission itself, and then the significance of the program and the moon landings. At the end, I've included a short state of the podcast update, so please stay tuned for that. With that being said, let's begin. In October 1958, the administration of Dwight David Eisenhower approved Project Mercury, the first human spaceflight program of the United States. The goal was to put a man into orbit and return him safely to Earth, hopefully before the Soviet Union. Lasting from 1958 through 1963, it had 11 successes and 3 failures. It failed in beating the Soviets into space, but it was also successful in many ways. First, it restored American pride after the failures of the early years of the space program. Second, it was scientifically a successful precursor to the Gemini and the Apollo programs. Indeed, without Mercury, there would have been no Apollo moon landings. Some of the accomplishments of this first program seem mundane, but they were important. First, they encountered the problem of personal hygiene. How would astronauts go to the bathroom? Bathe. They also encountered problems such as post-flight low blood pressure. Some of the mechanical aspects of spaceflight that were tested were things like the launch escape system, the heat shield, spacecraft aerodynamics, things of that nature. So the Mercury program also had some animals that were used in testing. For example, you had Little Joe 2, the testing of an escape system with a primate on board. It was a success, and the monkey, named Sam, was recovered. Speaking of the use of animals, it wasn't always successful. In the late 1940s, there were a series of test flights involving the use of monkeys, which ended in failure. But the 1960s were different. Mercury Redstone 2 was the final test of the Mercury capsule before it was certified safe for humans. This flight had some new systems such as environmental control systems, attitude stabilization control systems, and a voice communication system. The monkey on board was named Ham. He was successfully recovered from the capsule, although the mission had aborted due to the spacecraft running out of liquid oxygen fuel. This was due to a malfunction which caused the flight path angle to be off by about 1 degree, which doesn't sound like much, but it was rising, and that caused problems. This led to the launch escape system firing, and the test aborted. In the end, Ham overshot his planned landing area by about 130 miles. Just as an FYI, Ham was reported to be in good shape and accepted an apple and an orange. He was transferred after his flight to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and died in January 1983 at the ripe old age of 26. His remains were buried at the New Mexico Museum of Space History in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Freedom 7, piloted by Alan Shepard, a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and a naval aviator, was launched in May 1961, and Shepard became the second person to travel in space. His flight lasted 15 minutes and only reached an altitude of 108 nautical miles. This is compared to the flight of Yuri Gagarin, who flew for 108 minutes, but did so in a spacecraft 3 times bigger than the Mercury capsule and on an automatic flight path. Shepard, on the other hand, did have some flight control. There is a quote from Alan Shepard that is told by Gene Kranz in the book Failure is Not an Option. Now, if you saw the film Apollo 13, he's depicted by actor Ed Harris and was famous for his dapper mission vests made by his wife, Marta Kranz. Anyway, he quotes Shepard as saying, when asked by reporters what he was thinking about as he sat there waiting for the launch, quote, "The fact that every part of this ship was built by the lowest bidder," end quote. The Mercury program's two biggest achievements were mission Mercury Atlas 6 and Mercury Atlas 9. MA-6 was the first American orbital spaceflight, piloted by John Glenn. The mission lasted 4 hours and 55 minutes in total, and Glenn orbited the Earth 3 times. The next two missions, MA-7 and 8, were both slowly increasing their time in space. But the final Mercury mission, MA-9, increased the time in space significantly, from 9 hours for MA-8 to 1 day, 10 hours for MA-9. Piloted by Leroy Cooper, the youngest of the original 7 Mercury astronauts, this was the final mission which would have a solo astronaut on board. The second of NASA's spaceflight programs was the Gemini program. Now, the first thing that you might have noticed is the pronunciation. The official pronunciation, as stated by NASA in 1965, was Gemini, not Gemini. Anyway, this was essentially a bridge program designed to develop and test techniques which would support the Apollo program and get men to the moon, which was the goal set for the program by President Kennedy. The program would launch, just as Mercury had, from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Their launch vehicle was the Gemini Titan II, a modified intercontinental ballistic missile. The astronaut corps was expanded from the original Mercury 7 to include the new 9 and the 1963 astronaut class. Out of the new 9, 6 flew to the moon, including Neil Armstrong, with 2, Jim Lovell and John Young, flying to the moon twice. Group 3 was made up of 14 men, 4 of whom died in training accidents before they could fly. Now, Gemini was built by the McDonnell Aircraft Corporation and had several objectives. First was to demonstrate the endurance of both humans and machines in space for extended periods, at least 8 days, which would be needed for a journey to the moon. The second goal was to be able to rendezvous and dock with a vehicle in space, as well as to maneuver. This was essential, as the Apollo spacecraft would need to maneuver and dock with the third stage of the Saturn rocket to retrieve the lunar module. The third was to determine the ability, or demonstrate the ability, to do what is called extravehicular activity, and assess if an astronaut could perform tasks in that environment. The fourth goal was to perfect the re-entry and touchdown in a pre-selected area. Just an overview of the flights that made up the program. Gemini 1 was the first flight, obviously, one that lasted almost 4 days. It was an unmanned flight and was intentionally destroyed during re-entry. Gemini 2 was a suborbital flight designed to test the heat shield, and it lasted 18 minutes. Gemini 4 was the second manned Gemini flight and lasted for 4 days. This was notable for the first spacewalk by an American, astronaut Ed White. Gemini 5 was the first week-long flight and was notable for the first use of fuel cells for power. Gemini 7 lasted for 13 days and 18 hours, attempting to determine if humans could live in space for 2 weeks. Gemini 9, in March 1966, accomplished the first docking with another space vehicle, in this case an unmanned target vehicle. It was also notable for being the first American spacecraft to suffer a critical in-space system failure, which threatened the lives of the astronauts and required an immediate abort. So this brings us to the Apollo program. Running from 1961 through 1972, the first manned flight took place in 1968. It was a massive success, of course, landing a man on the moon in 1969, despite a setback in 67 when disaster struck, but more on that momentarily. Not only did it achieve its goal of putting men on the moon, but it also set several human spaceflight milestones. As of this recording, it is the only program to send a crew beyond low Earth orbit. Apollo 8 was the first manned spacecraft to orbit another celestial body. Finally, Apollo 17 was the sixth and final mission to land on the moon. Now, the Apollo spacecraft itself, and I have a diagram on the website which you ought to check out, was similar to the Mercury and Gemini vehicles in that they were single-shot vehicles. The Apollo spacecraft, however, was composed of 3 sections and it was more advanced. It had a combined command and service module, known as a CSM, and the LM, or the lunar module. It also had two additional components for assembly to the stack for launch. The SLA, or the spacecraft LM adapter, the purpose of which was to shield the spacecraft from the aerodynamic stresses of launch, and an LES, a launch escape system, to carry the crew safely away from the launch vehicle in the event of a launch emergency. The spacecraft was launched into space by the Saturn V rocket, which was in use by NASA from 1967 through 1973. It was launched 13 times from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida without the loss of a crew or a payload. As of this recording, it is still the tallest, heaviest, and the most powerful rocket ever brought to operational status by any country. It is also still the only launch vehicle to ever carry humans beyond low Earth orbit. Now, in my opinion, and it's just my opinion, this rocket was a marvel, and the cancellation of production in the early 1970s in favor of the space shuttle and its solid rocket boosters was a major mistake. There were plans to use the Saturn V to launch the space shuttle, and had NASA gone with that design, the Challenger accident, which took place in 1986, would probably never have happened. Further, the Saturn V rockets continued to be used, if they continued to be used. The ISS would have been built much faster, as there would have been fewer launches needed to get all of the components into space. Now, this, of course, is the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, so let's get on to that mission. The three astronauts on board this mission were Neil Armstrong, a former naval aviator. He served in the Korean War, flying a total of 78 missions over Korea. The second crew member was Michael Collins. Now, Michael Collins was a 1952 graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and an Air Force pilot who eventually obtained the rank of Major General. The final member was Buzz Aldrin, also a West Point graduate and Air Force pilot. The launch took place on July 16, 1969, at 09:32 Eastern Daylight Time. The Apollo 11 spacecraft entered Earth orbit at an altitude of 100 nautical miles, approximately 12 minutes into flight. It only spent 1.5 orbits in Earth orbit before it ignited the second engine to push the vehicle on its trajectory to the moon. 30 minutes after it was on its way to the moon, with Collins at the controls, the maneuver to dock and extract the lunar module was completed. Interestingly, the remaining rocket stage continued to fly on a trajectory past the moon, while the combined Apollo spacecraft and lunar module headed to the moon itself. This was done to ensure the third stage of the rocket did not collide with either the spacecraft or the moon or even the Earth itself. In case you were wondering, the rocket passed the moon and was slingshotted, is that a word, slingshotted, into orbit around the sun. Now, I don't need to say the mission was a success, but there was a bit of problems during this time, and probably the worst time, the lunar descent. About 5 minutes into that descent burn at 6,000 feet above the surface of the moon, the guidance computer suddenly gave several program alarms. What was happening was that the computer was unable to complete all of its tasks in real time and was having to postpone some of them, thus the alarm or the error messages. However, this was actually an indication that the computer was doing what it was supposed to be doing. The computer was actually programmed to do more than just recognize error conditions. It contained software to eliminate lower priority tasks and continue on with the important ones. So it was operating as designed. Of course, I think if I was flying that thing and you had alarms going off, it'd probably freak me out. Speaking of the computer, just in case you were wondering, it was the equivalent of a home computer in the late 1970s. Something like the Apple II or the TRS-80. Now, sadly, the program would be canceled within a few years of the first moon landing. Why? Costs. The Vietnam War had worn on for years, and the United States was feeling the pressure of that war, having expended a lot of blood and treasure. The 1970s would be a rough decade economically for the United States. The Nixon administration made the fateful decision to press forward with the space shuttle program, which many believed would be far cheaper and thus more cost-effective. So what was the impact or the legacy of the moon landings? First, the Apollo program, in my estimation, has to be considered the greatest technological achievement in human history. Culturally, the impact was massive. Apollo 8 sent the first live pictures of the Earth and the moon back to Earth. Approximately one quarter of the population of the entire world saw, either live or delayed, the Christmas Eve transmission of Apollo 8 orbiting the moon, and about one-fifth of the entire population watched the live transmission of the Apollo 11 moonwalk. Further, the photos taken by astronauts affected the environmental movement of the 1970s. According to The Economist, the program also demonstrated the superiority of the free market system to communism. However, looking back, I can't help but feel a bit of sadness. It seems as if the ball was dropped, so to speak, in the aftermath of this amazing achievement. Human beings have not visited the moon in almost 50 years now, and we have failed to push on to Mars. NASA itself has done a remarkable job of probing the solar system with robotic vehicles, but the aforementioned decision to pursue the space shuttle program meant NASA abandoned the Apollo spacecraft and the Saturn V rocket. Again, a mistake in my mind. You might argue that we needed to push forward, but here we are in 2019 without a launch vehicle. The Russians, who developed the Soyuz spacecraft in the 1960s, still use it. I should add, the vehicle has gone through many upgrades and is, in fact, in its fourth generation. There's no reason that the United States couldn't have done the same, and hindsight shows, I think, that it, in fact, should have done so. Okay, so now, the state of the podcast. As I record this on August 24th, we are close to the end of Season 2. As the plan stands right now, we have about 6 episodes to go. It is very likely I will have them all written by October 15th, fingers crossed, and hopefully recorded as well, again, fingers crossed. If, for once, everything goes as planned, that's the way things will go. After that, we will step away from the war for a bit in Season 3, which will cover the Progressive Era and the Great Depression. Now, as of today, Season 3 will be shorter than Season 2. As it stands, I have planned 16 episodes, although once I start writing, the number should increase. But I don't think there will be more than 30 episodes. But again, who knows? So here's the plan, at least hopefully. I'll have all of Season 2 written and recorded by the middle of October, like I said, and then I can start researching and writing Season 3. If everything goes well, I'll have the final episode of the Mexican War out sometime early in the new year, and then we can start releasing the Great Depression after that. We will continue to stick with the once-a-month plan for the foreseeable future, except on special occasions when I will release more than one per month. Finally, I want to address our Patreon site. Now, I have to admit, it hasn't received the support I'd hoped it would. That could be for any number of reasons. But right now, we have too few supporters to justify my working on a completely separate show. Now, to be quite honest, I was disheartened by this, I think, as any of us would be. You start something new and you're very excited about it, and then, for no better expression, it really did flop. But hey, these things happen. What I'm going to do is continue to research and write episodes for it, and once we have 40 subscribers, I'll start posting those episodes once again. So let me take this time to ask you to listen to the episode we published a few months ago as a teaser for the show 1983, The Year the World Almost Ended. And if you enjoy our show overall and you find that episode intriguing, please head over to theamericanhistorypodcast.com. At the bottom of the page, you'll see a button that says Become a Patreon. Click on that, and you'll be taken directly to our page on Patreon, and you can sign up. For only $3 a month, you can help support the show and help keep us free and independent. But let me take this time just to thank you for listening to the main show. If that's the only way you can support us, it is truly appreciated. Don't think for a minute it's not. It really is. I never thought the show would actually last this long, and there have been some days when I thought maybe I should stop, but I do enjoy it, and it seems like we do have a little bit of a following, so the show will definitely continue. But like I said, all of your support, it really is appreciated. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much. Anyway, that's it for this little bonus episode. I hope you liked this overview of the space program, and I hope you have a fantastic day.